Welcome to today's edition of the Rush Limbaugh Show podcast.
And a very good Friday to you. Open line Friday, 800-282-2882. Thrilled to be here with you today as your guide host. And still considering what it was that we saw laid out 24 hours ago, 48 hours ago, with President Joe Biden speaking in the House of Representatives to the semi-joint gathering of the Congress and the Senate, laying out a $6 trillion spending package. Just let that number sink in. It's really an unbelievable thing. And it prompted Lindsey Graham to describe what it was that Joe Biden was talking about there at the Congress, as saying he embraced socialism and made Barack Obama look like Ronald Reagan. Now, for what it's worth, Joe Biden was no Ronald Reagan, because his numbers were pretty much anemic when it came to the people tuning into the speech just a couple of days ago. 22.6 million viewers, less than half of Trump's audience in 2017 for that debut speech. And this was a speech that we knew going in was going to be anchored, absolutely anchored to the notion of free money. Free money, free stimulus, free stuff. Don't worry about it. It's going to be great. You get a trillion and you get a trillion and you get a trillion and you get a trillion, to paraphrase Oprah Winfrey. But the reality of what's being offered by Joe Biden is starting to really set in with people. They're starting to understand what this means, what the stakes mean here. It's barely 10 years since this last experiment was played out with then President Barack Obama and Vice President Joe Biden at the time, when against the worst meltdown, breakdown, collapse since the Great Depression, that was the original one, we were going to have to start shoveling out money, almost $1 trillion in stimulus money, going out there for so-called shovel-ready jobs. And remember, it was Joe Biden who was Sheriff Joe back then. He was in charge of distributing the dollars out there to the people. Well, not really to the people. Remember what the purpose of that first stimulus was back in 2009, and it was what prompted the birth of the Tea Party that led to the Republican takeover of the House back in 2010. And the original sales pitch was this. It was, we need this money to shore up municipalities and counties and their workers who would otherwise be furloughed. We need to pay these people this money. And then, but don't worry about it. It's going to end up cycling back into the economy. Things are going to be cool. People will be running out there to the different big box stores and buying groceries and buying televisions and continuing to keep that economy going. All the while, that same federal government was buying toxic assets and expanding the Federal Reserve and of course, devaluing the dollar across the spectrum, right? That's what took place back in 2009. So what we've got now is, paraphrasing Joe Biden from two nights ago, we had Joe Biden saying it's the worst crisis that we have faced since the Great Depression, and we need not one, not two, not five, but $6 trillion additional dollars to fundamentally transform the United States of America. Back in 2011, Rush Limbaugh said the Obama stimulus had failed. And by the way, that applies to this forthcoming stimulus by Joe Biden.
Look, we know that Obama stimulus plan was nothing more than a money laundering slush fund. We know that now. We know that in any number of ways, learning it most recently from Wisconsin. A full 80% of the money that Wisconsin got went to the public sector unions. And, of course, that money, a percentage of that just goes right back to the Democrat Party. But let's say, just for the sake of discussion, playing devil's advocate, let's say that Obama simply is a misguided, well-intentioned statist. And he really believes that massive government spending to the tune of $1 trillion will grow an economy and create jobs and all that. You need to first ask a question. How do we define growth? Is growth not the pie getting bigger? Economic growth means that the gross domestic product, the economic output, the sum total of it, increases, meaning brand new jobs are created. People with jobs are compensated with raises, higher incomes. New products are invented, and the pie grows. That's what economic growth is. It can be nothing else. Otherwise, you have stagnation, or if you have depression, you've got negative growth, which is the economy shrinking, getting smaller, which, in fact, is what's happening. Okay, so we've defined growth. Now let's say, ask ourselves, how does it happen? The government wants our economic pie to get bigger. And here comes Obama, so I got the plan. We're going to spend $1 trillion. We're going to put that $1 trillion to work immediately. We're going to inject that $1 trillion right into the economy. Ooh, cool. But is it going to be $1 trillion that's not in the economy already? In other words, where's the government going to get the money? If the government is going to take the money from somewhere else in the economy and spend it somewhere else in the economy, what you have is not growth but shifting. But you have no growth. And that's what the stimulus bill purportedly, that's not even what it ended up doing, but that was how they sold it. Keynesian spending. We're going to grow the economy. We're going to put $1 trillion in it. Where'd they get it? You have to borrow it, print it, tax it, or what have you. But it wasn't created out of growth. In fact, the way the money was procured would lead to economic stagnation. If anything, it would not lead to growth. Never has. If Keynesian economics worked, if pumping government money into a faltering economy worked, there would never be a faltering economy. We would have learned it the first time. It would have worked, and every recession that came along, every near depression that came along, all we'd have to do is pump some money into it and voila, be over with. It never works, does it? A guy, the Heritage Foundation, Brian Riedel, came up with an analogy to explain why government intervention to boost the economy doesn't work. He used a swimming pool. Removing water from one end of a swimming pool and pouring it in the other end will not raise the overall water level. In fact, it won't change anything after a while. It might make the deeper end deeper for a brief time. It might make the shallow end shallower for a brief time, but then it all levels out. Well, it's the same premise. If you take dollars from one part of the economy, i.e. the rich, and you distribute those dollars to another part of the economy, you're not growing anything. You're simply redistributing. And if in the process the recipients of your redistribution are getting it for not doing anything, if there's no accompanying activity to warrant the receipt of that money other than they're just sitting there and they happen to be Democrat voters, then you're really screwing yourself. And that's under the best laid plans. That's what the stimulus was. I mean, being totally well-intentioned. We know that's not what it was. We know it was a slush fund. We know, folks, it was nothing more than a money laundering scheme. We know that now. But if they really were just mistaken and they thought they could inject $1 trillion by redistributing it, it doesn't work. It has never worked, and it will never work. So the question then is, do these guys know that and are just lying to us? Are they really economically ignorant and utopian fools who really believe this stuff? At this point, I don't care. All I know is that they're dead wrong, and what they're doing has been destructive. It's got to stop.
And it did stop under the Trump administration. But it's coming back now. And it's coming back in part because it is a slush fund. 100,000 new teachers, preschool teachers, home aid caregivers, all those folks that are being promised these jobs by the Biden administration are simply going to be wealth transfers going to people who are members of the union. The bailouts that are going out to the municipalities for fiscally reckless behaviors. These are not windfalls for these communities. These are wealth transfers. And what's even worse is you've got under the Biden administration a promise to tax every aspect of your life, whether it's corporate taxation, capital gains taxation, whether it's personal income taxation. You've got all of that being combined to such a degree that Karl Marx himself would blush with embarrassment at the absolute gall to go out and try to rip that amount of money out of the economy, destroying growth. Zero Hedge, Tyler Durden over at Zero Hedge, and I know that's it's not a real name, obviously, but at Zero Hedge, a record 34% of all household income in the United States now comes from the government. 34% of all household income in the United States comes from the government. Well, because you have to factor in all the money that's transferring out of the coffers, unemployment benefits, welfare checks, you name it. It's government sourced income, and now we're going to pump another $6.1 or $6 trillion out into the dollars. He notes in this piece that I think is absolutely fascinating, putting the number in perspective. In the 1950s and 1960s, transfer payments from the government to people was about 7%. It is now approaching 34% in terms of transfers. This should frighten everybody who is paying attention to the current state of affairs in our country. Our future depends on us getting this right and preaching the basic fiscal sanity to our fellow citizens so we can prevent another $6 trillion transfer from going out. Coming up next, we have seen another injustice carried out by the Department of Justice. I'm Brett Winterbull. I'm your guide host today on the Rush Limbaugh Show on the EIB Network. And I am Brett Winterbull. I am your guide host today on the EIB Network on the Rush Limbaugh Show. And we were just talking about how it is all this money is starting to slosh around the economy, coming courtesy of you, the taxpayer, and you, the striver, and you, the hardworking person who is desperate to see the economy open back up, while Joe Biden wants to spend another $6 trillion of your dollars to engage in transfers from the federal government into the pockets of people, whether citizen or not, because we know a lot of the money is also going to folks who are in this country in an unauthorized, read, illegal fashion. And we've got to keep an eye on these sorts of things, right? An injustice anywhere is an injustice everywhere. And that takes me to the Department of Justice. Oh, the Department of Justice. Under Trump, it was the Department of Justice. Under the Biden administration, it appears to be the Department of Just Us. They obtained a search warrant to raid Rudy Giuliani's home looking for electronic devices. And that latest warrant obtained to a person connected to former President Trump. That's how it's described. How is it that the media knew about it? How is it that it was on hand with cameras when agents were going in and out of the residence of those served with the warrant? You know, it's very reminiscent. It's very reminiscent of what happened at the Roger Stone house and, you know, house raid, right? Remember when that happened? Well, we're going to explore that in just a moment. But Rudy Giuliani was on Tucker Carlson last night on the Fox News channel, and he actually gave us a little twist to the information when they came in to raid his computers and equipment, what have you. It was going to include a couple of other things, but they didn't want it. Go.
When they had taken about, I'd say, 7 or 8 electronic items of mine, which is what they took, and 2 of someone else's, they weren't taking the 3 hard drives, which, of course, are electronic devices. They just mimic the computer. I said, well, don't you want these? And they said, what are they? I said, those are Hunter Biden's hard drives. And they said, no. I said, are you sure you don't want them? I mean, the warrant required them to take it. And they said, no. One last time, I said, don't you think you should take it? And they said, no. Now, Hunter Biden's hard drives fall within the scope of the subpoena. The subpoena required them to take all electronics, but they decided to leave that behind. And they also were completely content to rely on my word that these were Hunter Biden's hard drives. I mean, they could have been Donald Trump's. They could have been Vladimir Putin's. They could have been anybody's. But they relied on me, the man who had to be raided in the morning.
I mean, that's incredible. They offered the Hunter Biden hard drives. Well, remember when Rush talked about the breathless nature of the Roger Stone arrest?
CNN had somehow exclusive video of the raid at Stone's house. And CNN saying, hey, we're just good journalists here. You know, we were minding our own business over at the grand jury, and we noticed a whole lot of unusual activity. And so that told us we had to stake out Stone's house. How stupid did they think we are? Obviously, the special counsel's office tipped them off because the special counsel's office wanted the video. They didn't get video storming Manafort. They learned their lesson. Now they want video as they storm into Stone's house. Because as a previous caller said, the video of all these agents under cover of darkness. Why do you go in there at 6 o'clock to make sure this disgustingly vile criminal can't sneak out and escape? You go in there when he's asleep. And so the pictures, the video, is designed to prove the legitimacy of the investigation. Because people will conclude, my God, this guy must, they really must have the goods on this guy to go this length. They must be really afraid this guy's going to hop a plane to Venezuela if we don't capture him while he's asleep. And that's what the media is out then helping people to understand. Here's CNN talking about the breaking news of the arrest of Roger Stone.
We do have breaking news, perhaps major breaking news, in the Russia investigation. The FBI has arrested political activist, Trump associate and friend, Roger Stone. CNN's camera was there as it happened. Watch this.
FBI, open the door.
Did you hear that? Banging on the door. Open the door, FBI! Open the door, FBI! Warrant! Stone's in there, sawing Z's. His dog and his wife are in there. Sound asleep, just like Manafort was when they raided his house at 6 a.m. You know, you want to talk about lying? How about the lies they told to the FISA court about the Steele dossier? They want to get all these Trump guys for lying in process crimes, lying to investigators. How about the FBI, Rosenstein, Comey, and all the rest of them lying to the FISA court as each of these FISA warrants to spy on the Trump campaign were renewed? Those are lies, too. But, of course, none of that being investigated. Here is the breathless CNN Allison Camerota asking the crime and justice producer, who just happened to note all of the activity of the grand jury, why he was even on the scene at Stone's house.
What's so fascinating is that we've talked to his attorney. The attorney didn't know this was coming. Clearly, Roger Stone didn't know this was coming. You were staked out at his house. You didn't know that this was coming. Why were you there in position?
Allison, it's a reporter's instinct. The whole Russia team thought maybe something was happening. There was some unusual grand jury activity in Washington, D.C. yesterday. Robert Mueller's grand jury typically meets on Fridays. Yesterday, a Thursday, there was grand jury activity. We also had some other signs that maybe something was going on this angle, the Roger Stone angle. So we showed up at his house this morning. We were the only ones there. And lo and behold, the FBI agents did come and arrest him.
Imagine that. Lo and behold. Yeah. Something was happening Thursday that normally happens Friday, so we're the only ones that showed up. And then when the FBI shows up, they didn't kick the media out. They welcomed him. I wonder if they had a box of donuts and coffee for him. Think the FBI had donuts and coffee for CNN, or was it the other way around? Did CNN bring coffee and donuts for the FBI?
Exactly. That's exactly how that worked. This is the most fortunate group of people imaginable. Just so happened to be there when the FBI rolls in. Just so happened to be there. And there's Rudy Giuliani saying essentially, hey, if you're going to take these computers, take these files, take this, why don't you take these? What are those? Those are the Hunter Biden hard drives. No, we don't want them. We don't know. We can't take those. What are you, crazy? We don't want to get lit up. Plenty more straight ahead. I'm Brent Winterbull on the EIB Network. You can't go a couple of miles without looking at folks who are out there across this country desperately working hard and trying to make sure this country continues to succeed. I see so many people around my area and more broadly this part of the country who are busily going about their days. Much of the lockdowns and the shutdowns where we are here have been lifted. But I know in many other places it's still sort of aspirational. We know that the intent is to lift the lockdowns, the COVID lockdowns, in New York at some point so that people can get back to the business of being robbed and assaulted on the streets of Bill de Blasio's metropolis. But the reality is people really do want to work. And why is it that people want to work? It's because they feel called to do it, but they also feel this inner desire and burning and yearning to provide for their families. It's why you get up every day with that alarm clock while it's dark outside, and you start working and providing for your family and for your loved ones. Well, if you think about that piece that we were referencing in the beginning of the program, this piece out of Zero Hedge talking about 34% of all household income in the United States is now being derived from the government, you'd be right to be worried about whether or not that American dream is going to go away. Is it in danger? In fact, Rush talked about this, asking the question, right? Have liberals succeeded in replacing the American dream with class envy?
To the extent that half the people in the country think the American dream's dead, that means half the American people are being told it's dead. That means, and this is very sad, it means that way too many people are not being reminded by leaders of the greatness of this country. Thomas Sowell, where is this? He has a great, great quote. Let me see if I can paraphrase it. Well, I'm going to botch it if I paraphrase it. But it's essentially the how much ahead of the game you are being born in America. And what a crime it is that so many people in this country do not understand that. Our leaders today, and by that I mean the Democrat Party, the American left from Obama on down, do nothing but attack the American people. They beat us up every day. We get nothing but criticism from this administration and from the Democrat Party. Greedy, selfish. We consume too much energy. We have more than our fair share of everything, from salt to food to trans fats. We drive the wrong cars. We use the wrong kind of light bulbs. We don't pay enough in taxes. We use too much health care. The people who lead this country are dumping on us, the achievers in this country, each and every day, and blaming us, blaming you, blaming the achievers for all the problems, not only in this country, but in the world. So it's totally understandable to me, but unacceptable, that half the people in this country think the American dream is dead when we don't have political leaders extolling the whole concept of American exceptionalism anymore. You know what I remember about the 80s and the Reagan years? There's one thing that stands out. Everybody, you who weren't alive or who are too young, you don't realize the misery of the late 70s. I mean, it was as bad as it is today. It was horrible. Add gasoline lines, add all kinds of skyrocketing energy prices to everything else that was going on, to the incompetence of a peanut farmer in the White House. I mean, there was a misery index to describe it. Even our own president described the country as being in a malaise. It was bad. And there were people talking about the end of America's salad days even then. Then Reagan got elected. And there was immediately, even in the midst of a recession, the 81-82 recession, there was an immediate transformation. People all of a sudden were up and happy and were saying, you know what, we've got to go through this. This is a much-needed corrective measure, this economic mess that we're in, because a bunch of stuff has been going on that was fraudulent and phony. This correction has to happen. And I remember, maybe it was, I don't remember where it was, television show, I don't even remember who it was, but some people were analyzing, well, what has Reagan done for the country? I mean, the tax cuts had happened, but they really hadn't kicked in. The Reagan economic boom was just beginning, but it hadn't started. What's Reagan done? And the very simple answer, he's made people feel good about the country again. Ronald Reagan made people feel good about their country again. Made them proud to feel Americans. Is Obama making you proud to feel Americans? Is anybody in the Democratic Party making you proud of being an American? No, they're blaming you. You're destroying the climate. You're destroying the polar bear habitat. You're doing this. You're doing that. You're eating too much. You're too fat. You're driving the wrong kind of car. You don't care enough about the disadvantage. You're a racist, you're a sexist, you're a bigot, and you're a homophobe. And half the people who hear this happen to agree with it. Half the people are already down on themselves anyway. And so when Obama says, we're no longer going to be a country that leads the world economically, thank God, now I don't have to work hard. So to the extent that we have economic stagnation in this country, it's not just because of the destructive policies of this regime. It's because of their attitudes. It is their purpose. They are seeking to create this defeatist attitude. And the Democrats hated Reagan. Oh, yeah, Reagan sees everything through rose-colored glasses. What Reagan sees is unreal. That's not that America can exist anymore. Frankly, I'm fed up with this view of America that they have.
It's incredible. Point for point, it applies to where we are right now, after a year in this pandemic and in this government-created catastrophe of shutdowns and lockdowns. Did you ever think, be honest, regardless of your political orientation, you could be a liberal, you could be a conservative, did you ever think there would be a time where people would be paid not to work to such an extent that they would refuse to then go to work? I mean, we've been through disasters before. We've been through 9/11. We've been through the Great Depression. We've been through the malaise of the 70s, as Rush talked about. But, I mean, did you ever think that people would say, you know what, I'm not going to work because I'm getting a really good check here from the government. I'm going to take my STEMI money and I'm going to take some time off and spend time at home. What? And the people who are going to save this, it could be you and me, and it's going to be some of the millennials. Good portion of the millennials. I don't think they're lost, though they have been certainly demoralized by a couple of meltdowns. It's going to be Gen Z. Those kids born in 95 and after into the early 2010s, because those are the kids that are college and high school kids that saw up close and personal the ravages of the post economic meltdown collapse in 2008. And who saw the very good years, the 4 years of Trump where the economy was on fire, where unemployment was 3%. You didn't imagine that. You did not imagine that. I did not imagine that. The money in your pocket, you did not imagine that. The pride you felt, you did not imagine that. Across the spectrum, you did not imagine that. This was not a dream. What this was a catastrophe that struck our nation. And now you have a person in the White House who is saying the only way forward is for me to open the Treasury to save you. When the fundamentals of the businesses that were out there, who have certainly suffered in the shutdowns, but the fundamentals are still there. People still know how to run businesses. People still know how to adapt. People still understand all of that. The American dream isn't dead. Joe Biden is attempting to push it into hiding. But it's there. It's there. I have a couple of young teenagers and a child in college. And the two of them have found employment. And when they went in for their interviews, what they effectively heard was, we're so glad you're here. We've been desperate to hire. People don't want to come out and work. Those kids, those teenagers, those young people, those are going to be the people who are going to be the next generation of capitalism. And we need to support that. We need to encourage that. They have a sense of duty and a sense of worth. And they have a burning desire. We should remember that. I'm Brett Winterble, your guide host today on the Rush Limbaugh Show on the EIB Network. And welcome back to the EIB Network and the Rush Limbaugh Show. I'm Brett Winterble. One of the things that continues to perplex me as I look at what's taken place in the last 48 hours was the fact that it took Twitter 11 hours to remove the Tim Scott Uncle Tim slur that was trending on their platform. Trending on their platform. 11 hours to go out and correct that. 11 hours to afford the honor and dignity that a sitting U.S. senator deserves in Senator Tim Scott. You know, Rush talked about the real racism that's out there on the Democrat side.
If you want to start throwing a racist label around, I think most racism today is actually on the Democrat side. Let's say liberals. Liberals will look at people and not see an individual. They'll see a gender, they'll see a color of skin, and then they'll automatically assign that person into a group and then have a view of that person, usually as a victim, based on that. When you assign somebody victim status, you're basically saying they're incompetent. You're saying they're incapable of overcoming the obstacles in life, and you come up with excuses for them to be victims, and that way you get their vote. But you have no respect for them. I think that's the real secret here of where real racism lies.
With that in mind, I want you to tell me if the montage that I'm about to play for you sounds like someone who's insensitive to those hearing these words that span the course of 14 years.
So you got the first sort of mainstream African American who is articulate and bright and clean and nice looking guy.
You cannot go to a 7-Eleven or a Dunkin' Donuts unless you have a slight Indian accent. And I'm not joking.
Unchain Wall Street.
They're going to put you all back in chains.
We have this notion that somehow if you're poor, you cannot do it. Poor kids are just as bright and just as talented as white kids.
The reason I was able to stay sequestered in my home is because some black woman was able to stack the grocery shelf.
If you have a problem figuring out whether you're for me or Trump, and you ain't black.
One of the challenges with the contention that there's systemic racism in the United States is got to be tied back to the experience of people who have been in government over a period of time. And it's a fair question to ask, what did you do to combat that? In fact, we've heard that question floated to the White House press secretary, Jen Psaki, and her answer was middling and muddled at best. But if you were a senator in the United States Senate starting in the early 1970s, you spent 40 years in the Senate, then became a vice president for 8 years. I think it's fair to ask, given that many of those statements were made when somebody was a senator. Many of those statements were made when somebody was a vice president. Many of those statements were made when somebody was campaigning to be the president of the United States. What's the track record in terms of the results of correcting the notion of systemic racism or correcting the systemic racism to which you point? I just wonder. It's just a question I'm throwing out there for you at 800-282-2882. You know, great news. If you're a podcast listener, you're going to want to listen to a new podcast hosted by our own James Golden. It is great to hear his voice on this program this week, and you'll enjoy hearing him on this latest podcast series. Here's James.
Thank you, Brett. I'm so excited for you to hear the new podcast series, Rush Limbaugh, the man behind the Golden EIB microphone. It's our chance to share with you what kind of man he was to be with and remind us all why he was so special to so many. It's a remarkable journey of triumphs, of challenges, and most of all, the pursuit of excellence. You'll find this podcast series starting May 12th on iHeartRadio or wherever you listen to your favorite podcast, presented by MyPillow and the Tunnel to Towers Foundation.
It is absolutely going to be phenomenal. I'm looking forward to it. I'm excited about it. And I can't wait to hear that very, very first episode. One of the things I learned being here with James and being here with Rush and this incredibly talented team here at the EIB Network for the number of years I was here and for the long number of years that I've remained friends with all of the folks here is this idea that it's a meritocracy. You come in and you do your best every single day. And the belief on this team was always this idea that we're going to put out the best possible show that we possibly can. And Rush was an amazing, amazing talent and an amazing leader and a person who could spot with uncanny ability the stories, the issues, the matters that mattered to everybody out there because they mattered to him. And so what's so incredible is to hear that behind-the-scenes story, those stories from James, who was here for the longest of the folks on the team, I believe, 32, 33 years. And the fact is, he's going to take you behind those scenes, not just the on air, Rush, but also the stuff that goes on behind the scenes. And I think it is such an incredibly valuable project. I know I am thrilled to be here today as your guide host. I'm Brett Witterbull, right here on the Rush Limbaugh Show on the EIB Network. And I am Brett Witterbull, your guide host on the EIB Network. Thrilled to be spending this time with you today. Not enough time to be fair with a caller, but I want to revisit something that we opened this hour with because it's a hugely important point, and I want everybody out there to kind of keep it front of mind. Right now, 34% of all household income in the United States is coming from the government. This is a piece penned over at ZeroHedge.com. And when you think about this number, we're talking about the transfer that goes out in a variety of ways. You talk about welfare payments, unemployment money, government payments. The creeping nature of these government payments are substantial. And to give you the perspective, in the 1950s and 60s, the transfer payments from the government coffers out to folks stood at 7%, even in the mid-70s. It was in the low teens. It's now 34%. What the government is effectively doing is creating a point of no return so that the next administration, when they come in, if they have a desire to reduce the spending, will not be able to do it. They'll be prohibited from doing it because of the damage that will be done. And isn't that probably the point? Isn't that likely the point? That if we put in place enough spending programs, any notion of so-called fiscal conservatism or even just basic conservatism will be out the window. We'll talk about it straight ahead. I'm Brett Witterbull. You're listening to the EIB Network. Whatever happened to the John Kerry scandal? Does anybody know what happened with the John Kerry scandal? The scandal involving the sharing of intelligence with the Iranian foreign minister. I know that John Kerry has denied that that was the case. I know that John Kerry has said unequivocally in a Twitter statement, which is, you know, just as good as like being under oath, I can tell you that this story and these allegations are unequivocally false. This never happened either when I was Secretary of State or since. See, what does he mean by this? Does he mean advising Javad Zarif? I mean, we know that. We know that he is a friendly to Javad Zarif. Does he mean the tipping off about the Iranian the Israeli operations against Iranians in Syria? Does he mean, what does he mean? What exactly does he mean? This is an incredible story because it has disappeared down the memory hole. It has just completely evaporated. It starts last Sunday, where the New York Times tries to deep six this as Mohammad Javad Zarif, who is the foreign minister of Iran. So he's sort of he would be, I could say the Anthony Blinken, but nobody knows who Anthony Blinken is. So he was sort of like the John Kerry of Iran. He's like the foreign minister, right? It's like the Secretary of State. He's a foreign minister of Iran, and he's BFFs with John Kerry. John Kerry is BFFs with Javad Zarif. I mean, they were advising each other, and he was talking to him constantly during the out years of the Trump administration, essentially telling him, okay, don't worry about it. Hang back. Everything's going to be cool. Once we get rid of Trump, then we can redo this nuclear deal thing, and we're all going to be smiling. But this idea that he's passing all this information over to the Zarif, and the fact that CNN, MSNBC, NBC, ABC, CBS, PBS, NPR, nobody's talking about this. And this is like only the latest insult from John Kerry. John Kerry's got himself a blind spot when it comes to Iran. In the later days of the Obama administration, when John Kerry was the Secretary of State and he was helping to, you know, shepherd that Iranian nuclear deal and all that sort of stuff that was going on, do you remember in January of 2016 when the Iranians took our sailors hostage and they humiliated our sailors? Does everybody remember that? There was video. They made video of them essentially saying, we're sorry that we went into your waters. We're sorry. We're really bad people. The Iranians are actually the sailors weren't forced to do that, but they were humiliated. The Iranians wanted them to do that. And for his part, John Kerry thanked Iran for taking our sailors hostage and humiliating them.
John F. Kerry, served in Vietnam, by the way, has thanked the Iranians for taking our sailors hostage and humiliating them. I'm not kidding on this either. John Kerry thanked Iran for humiliating our sailors, one of whom was a woman, by the way. Thanked them for rescuing them. Thanked them for humiliating. Well, that's what he did. He thanked them. He thanked the Iranians for capturing Americans engaged in harmless activity on a boat. Here is his soundbite from the State Department this morning.
I also want to thank the Iranian authorities for their cooperation and quick response. These are always situations which, as everybody here knows, have an ability, if not properly guided, to get out of control. And I'm appreciative for the quick and appropriate response of the Iranian authorities.
Yeah, all it takes is $150 billion in cash and a promise they can nuke up and they'll give us back some soldiers they took hostage. What the hell is this? They take some hostages. They capture a couple of little dinky boats we got running around over there, and they take the people on board hostage, and they release them, and we thank them. I want to thank the Iranian authorities for their cooperation, quick response. These are always situations which, as everybody here knows, of the ability, if not properly guided, to get out of control. Really want to thank the Iranians for taking our guys hostage and not doing anything worse. And we want to thank the Iranians for, after taking our guys hostage, that they gave them back. Really appreciate that. We're sorry. That's what he's essentially apologizing for what we did. Just saying, folks, you give somebody $150 billion and a green light to do a nuclear weapon, I mean, you're buying a lot of friendship there. In the meantime, controversy explodes over Iranian images of U.S. sailors. Iran today released a series of pictures and videos showing the 10 U.S. Navy sailors it apprehended yesterday, inflaming the American debate over their capture, including the question of whether the U.S. had formally apologized for entering Iranian territory. The Iranian media, made up of the Islamic Republic of Iran Broadcasting News Agency and Tasnim News Agency, published roughly 24 pictures and 5 videos, a couple of which feature a male sailor apologizing and praising Iran's treatment. It was a mistake that was our fault, and we apologize for our mistake. The Iranian behavior was fantastic while we were here, and we thank them very much for their hospitality and their assistance. We had no problems here. Think of it what you will. That's what the Iranians released as having transpired. That we apologized and praised them for treating us well, and the whole thing was our fault. Right. Folks, you can think what you want, but I'm going to tell you something. This kind of story where we apologized, and boy, the Iranians were so nice. Oh, my God, it was so much fun being with them. They were so nice. It was our fault. It was our, we shouldn't have been there. We apologized. They treated us so well. You might think that's cool. I'm telling you, that's one of the biggest propaganda victories that this satanic country could get. In Middle East, where this is the kind of stuff that matters, it's going to make it look like they totally dominate us. It's going to come across as another huge victory over the great Satan, the United States of America. Now, last night, in his State of the Union speech, Obama's going on and on. We're the most powerful country in the world. We got the best fighting force in the world. We got the best military in the world. We spend more on our military than the first 8 nations behind us combined. We're the greatest battle machine. Ask yourself a question. All of that may be true. We may be the most powerful nation in the world. What kind of rules of engagement are they saddled with? But more importantly than that, why? I'm dead serious about this. Why? Given that we have the most powerful military, the greatest fighting force ever, we can project more power than any nation on earth can even dream of, why are all of our enemies growing in power? Why are they getting bigger? Why are they stronger? Why are our enemies more dangerous than ever? Why are they bigger, more dangerous, and wreaking more havoc than ever before under Obama? That's how you measure it. We can have the best, most powerful fighting force in the world, and if it's led by a wuss or somebody who thinks that it's the problem in the world, what good is it under his command? And make no mistake, Barack Hussein Obama is one of these people that thinks the United States military is one of the greatest problems in the world, historically and at present. Do not doubt me. It falls right in line with this whole belief system that the United States is not the solution to the world's problems. We are the problem.
And so given all of that, why are we not having an investigation into what Kerry did with the foreign minister of Iran? We're just taking his word for it, right? There's absolutely no deterrence to continue doing this because it was John Kerry who also, after the strike on Soleimani, Qasem Soleimani, it was John Kerry who condemned the attack by Donald Trump, said, Trump's trying to distract. Trump is trying to cover something up by killing Qasem Soleimani, a guy who was responsible for the murders of thousands and thousands and thousands of innocent people, tens of thousands of innocent people in Syria, and hundreds, if not thousands, of American troops who were wounded and maimed in Iraq by Soleimani. So what is the deterrence for John Kerry to continue doing this? This is the same John Kerry, by the way, who ran for president in 2004. This is the same John Kerry who famously defended the trade with the Taliban for Bo Bergdahl, a guy who was a deserter. I mean, this guy has got a horrible... I think his track record on foreign policy is pretty closely as bad as President Biden's track record on foreign policy and Barack Obama's track record on foreign policy. It's absurd. And the media just disappears. Replace John Kerry talking to the Iranians with any Republican talking to the Iranians secretly. Doesn't even have to be a Trump administration official. You can go back to the George W. Bush years. Donald Rumsfeld was talking to the Iranians. We need an impeachment, said Adam Schiff. You know, somebody's going to say something like that. And the reason why it's important for there to be hearings into what John Kerry told the Iranians, okay, I know he's the climate czar. I get that for Joe Biden. But the reason why it's important for him to get out and testify in public about what he told the Iranians is to get him on the record, because if he commits perjury, he's got to get bounced and he's got to get prosecuted, number one. Number two, if you allow all this kind of do-it-yourself foreign policy to happen with these out-of-power progressive liberal Democrats, then they're going to keep doing it. And whatever president comes in next that's a Republican, they're going to just keep hotwiring the foreign policy, going around saying, don't worry about what's going on. No. Schiff's going to impeach him in 2 weeks. You don't have to do it. Don't pay attention. We can only have one president at a time. We can only have one foreign policy at a time, unless, of course, you're John Kerry, because everything is optional. 800-282-2882. That's the phone number to be a part of the conversation here on the Rush Limbaugh Show. I'm Brett Witterbull. I'm your guide host today on the EIB Network. Do you remember the good old days? Well, not really the good old days, but do you remember during the Obama administration, the news media got creative with negative branding and oftentimes would call unemployment fun employment? Do you remember this? This is incredible. Fun employment. It would extol the virtues of being able to pick up that hobby you love or to spend more time with the family. Then when no one had any money, they praised staycations. No money to go to the amusement park or to go camping. Just stay home and enjoy the peace and tranquility of your home. Now the media is acknowledging what we all know, right? That Biden is a dinosaur. But that's a good thing because, you know, he's not dramatic or scary or dangerous or any of that kind of thing. This is opinion piece. This is an opinion piece over at CNN. The best thing about President Joe Biden is that he's old. That means he can remember a time before and not just before the rightward swing of former President Donald Trump or even the centrism of former Presidents Bill Clinton and Barack Obama. Ah, you know what I can tell from the writer of this? Who is this? This is Meg Jacobs, who teaches history at Princeton. It means she's like late stage millennial because her grasp of history begins with Bill Clinton. Or maybe Ronald Reagan at best. I mean, this is what is so absurd when you think about this. Oh, you know, he doesn't have to just remember Donald Trump. He can remember another time, a different time. That's right. He remembers a time before small government proponent, former president Ronald Reagan, when Democrats stood before the country and said unabashedly that A big and bold government's exactly what the country needed. That's what makes Biden an old-fashioned New Deal liberal in all the best ways. You know, Rush remembered when we had fun unemployment.
Back to the phones, Denville, New Jersey. This is Alan. Thank you for waiting, and welcome to the EIB Network. Hi.
Before, when you were reading how Trump, when he was encouraging people to, you know, pursue your interests, follow your dreams, do what interests you, you have to like it. It's so selfish. Now it's very selfish. It's not proper to do. It made me recall years back under Obama's presidency when there was a high unemployment. We were told, I don't remember which person had said it, it might have been Pelosi, I'm not sure, but how it's really good to be unemployed because people now have time to pursue their interests and the things they really like, and it's really good. It just made me think of that, and it just shot right back to my mind. That
what a great memory. What a great recall that is. You're exactly right. Pelosi said that. It was Pelosi. She said something else. She said two things. They had a name for people losing their jobs rapidly in the Obama administration. It was called fun employment. You remember this?
Yes.
Pelosi and the Democrats said it's a great opportunity to get back together with family, to reconnect with people you haven't seen in a while. It's a wonderful opportunity. You now have time to explore things that you haven't had time for. It's a great thing. With unemployment insurance, it's a golden opportunity. And you're right. Then the next thing they said was, and it was specifically Pelosi, now you don't have to do that job that you've hated all along. If you want to go out and paint watercolors in Golden Gate Park and try to sell them down in the Tenderloin, you can do it. You no longer have to be a prisoner to a job that you don't like. You're exactly right about that. What a great recall. And that was all a way to mitigate the negative aspects of losing your gig.
Right, right, yep. It's funny how things change. The perspective changes depends on who's in office.
Right, exactly. So now, somebody at thehill.com saying, big mistake to follow your passions. Don't do it. It's selfish. When planning a career, plan a career of service. Plan a career of giving back to others. Following your passion is a very selfish thing to do, according to a liberal sociologist.
You know, of course it is. Happiness is anathema to big government. If you're happy, big government has to jump in there and figure out a way to make you less happy. If you're driving around smiling, happy about your job, you like what you're doing, you like your life, you like going to church, you like all that kind of stuff, and then you run across, in all seriousness, if you run across a bureaucrat of any kind, they will immediately begin scowling at, what are you happy about? But my gosh, could you imagine, had the pendulum gone in a different way, had we not had President Trump in office starting in 2017, had we had President Hillary Clinton in office in 2017 and for the 4 years, of the last 4 years, and if you had had Hillary Clinton in there and the pandemic had hit, she would have probably tried to use that same sales pitch that Pelosi used about the idea of, well, you know, I know the economy's shut down. We're going to take care of you. We've got checks going out. Make some s'mores. Make some s'mores in your apartment. It's totally good. Have you thought about getting involved in whittling or scrimshaw? Have you thought about scrapbooking? You know, this is a real opportunity to get involved. Oh, wait, what am I saying? No. No, that's not how she would have said. She would have said, well, since you're getting money from the government during this terrible time of COVID, here's a great opportunity for you. You can go and volunteer with Planned Parenthood. You can go and volunteer with Occupy Wall Street or whatever the latest iteration of that is. You can go join some of the PIRGs, those public interest research groups who collect. They like to collect petition signatures down in Tompkins Square Park in New York, or Washington Square Park, or the Rambles up in Central Park. Or you could. This is a really great opportunity to travel the rails, collecting your check, seeing America, like something in a Simon and Garfunkel video. People would go crazy. They couldn't have said this. See, Pelosi could never have said this after you had the sort of economy that Donald Trump had, because people liked coin in their pocket. People wanted to go back to work. The economy had gone so well that they knew if they had offered up fun unemployment, they would have absolutely had marches in the streets. No, it's going to be good. So what did they have to do? They had to scare you within an inch of your life so you didn't feel compelled to demand going back to work. That's what they did. Oh, no, it's dangerous to go. You got to wear your mask, and you got a triple mask, and you got a quadruple mask. You can't just go back to work. No, you can't go back to work. You got to stay home. Hey, look, we've got Zoom for you. You've got Zoom. You've got Google Hangouts. You've got Microsoft Meetings. This is just like you can work from home. And it's going to be wonderful. We don't want to reopen yet. Is the election done? Well, here's the deal. We'll look to be reopening, say, third week of February. That's right. We'll be looking to reopen then. That's when you can go back to work. But in the meantime, just enjoy your time watching Joe Biden car rallies. Brett Winterbull on the EIB Network. Remember that affordable gasoline back during the Trump years? Remember how you could get the gasoline? It wasn't a problem to get the gasoline. I remember how shocked I was to be able to get affordable gasoline, especially when I moved out of the socialist state of California, no longer having to pay $3 plus for gasoline or $3.50 plus for gasoline, but a much more reasonable price. That's one of the things that people seem to really enjoy about this the prior administration of Trump Pence. Well, coming this summer, get ready. Get ready if you're not. Millions of people stuck at home for more than a year are expected to hit the road for much-needed post-pandemic vacations this summer. Good luck finding gas.
In his daily news briefing just now, Jay Carney, White House press spokesman, said there's no magic solution to rising oil prices. President's very aware of the pain Americans feel at the pump. Now, isn't it funny? That's not what we heard from the Democrats during the summer of 2008. No. See, every time the gasoline price went up, why didn't Bush do something? Remember John Kerry, who, by the way, served in Vietnam? If he were president, he'd go over there and he'd tell the Saudis what for. He'd go over there. He wouldn't let the Saudis get away with this. He'd tell them what for. He'd make their minds right. He'd tell them what the reality of the world is. Every time the gas prices went up under Bush, Bush could do something about it. Heck, a lot of media people went around and said, oh, there's a magic guy behind the curtains in charge of gas prices. Wanted to set out to find out who it might be. I think rising gas price, say, what happened to Keystone Pipeline? Rising gas price, why is the drilling moratorium still going on in the Gulf? Rising gasoline price, why the obstacles to domestic production? And then if I were the Republicans, I go back and I get that Obama quote where he really wasn't unhappy that the price of gas had hit $4. He was just unhappy how rapidly it happened. See, the dirty little secret, folks, Obama wants high gas prices. Mr. Limbaugh, that is one of the most irresponsible things I've ever heard any talk show host. Well, it's very true, Mr. Nucastrati. High gas prices will push people out of their cars and into electric cars and hybrids, mass transit. High gasoline price, exactly what Obama wants. Obama wants pain. He wants interruptions to normalcy. Obama doesn't want you being able to cheaply move around the country, cheaply move around your town. Obama doesn't want that. This guy has invested everything he has, including your taxpayer dollars, into green energy. And you know the fraud that's going on there with the crony capitalism and the like. Obama's not unhappy with $4. Jay Carney, really not a whole lot that can be done about rising gas prices. I think John Kerry... Didn't John Kerry accuse Bush of having a secret deal with the Saudis? I think he did. The 2004 presidential campaign, he accused Bush of having some kind of secret deal to keep prices down during the campaign. Some silly thing. But if I were the Republicans, I would make hay out of this, if for no other reason than to settle a score. You go back to 2006, rising gas prices, and check all the quotes from Democrats accusing Bush of doing it on purpose, or accusing Bush's economic policies of causing it, or accusing Bush of not caring about it. Or, worse than that, Bush and Cheney personally profiting from it. You know, Cheney at Halliburton, Bush and the Bush family with big oil. Yeah, it's all coming back to me now. That's exactly what happened. They accused Bush and Cheney of profiting from rising oil prices. So damn right I'd turn it on them.
And the problem with those rising prices is, of course, all your goods go up. Anything that has to be trucked, anything that has to be moved, your groceries coming to your grocery store, that all requires gasoline or diesel to bring that to you. And so if gas prices are going up, then, of course, you have a situation where your groceries are going to get more expensive, right? I remember distinctly how it was the Obama administration, Obama-Biden, redefined the consumer price index. They pulled out all the stuff that you would normally use, like food, gasoline, and what was it? It was food, gasoline, and like utilities. And instead it was like tires, balsa wood, and shoes. Yeah, there's no indication of any kind of prices going up in that regard. But here's the important thing. Biden ends the outdoor mask mandate. COVID is ending. There aren't any more reasons for you to be stuck there at home. It's about conditioning for that Green New Deal. That's what it is. It's about saying, oh, you know, get ready. You have to have diminished expectations. It's not going to work. The idea that, you know, you go back to that staycation like we were talking about. And oh, by the way, by killing off the Keystone XL pipeline, just to harken back to a couple of prior segments ago, now you've got every reason in the world to have American troops stuck in the Middle East, because the Middle East oil is important to get out, because we're not producing it here. We're not going to produce here. And by the way, that Keystone XL pipeline that would have been flowing down through the Keystone XL pipeline, that's actually going to go out of Vancouver to the People's Republic of China, because they're still buying fuel oil. Yeah, they can still use oil over there. We can't use it necessarily here. We don't need as much. And this is the great scheme. This is the great flim flam that's being played out here. The nature of most Americans is not set within the confines of cities. Okay? The nature of most Americans is not set within the confines of cities, where we take subways everywhere, we take buses everywhere, we can walk, we take a scooter, an electric scooter, hither, dither, and yon. We can ride our bicycles, we can do all that kind of stuff. No, even in a state like California, right, which is environmental central and all that sort of stuff, even in California, people want to drive their cars. It's where car culture was born. And the reality is, you can come out as the president and say, we're going to do the Green New Deal. People want to drive. And COVID is only going to reinforce that, because who the heck wants to ride on a crowded bus with a bunch of people who might be hacking and coughing, and there may be another super spreader event? Why am I getting on a train? Why am I getting on a subway? Why am I getting on a bus? Drive around in my own car by myself, totally safely, you know, ensconced in the seat, so I don't have to run the risk of picking up COVID. I mean, I think cars, I think the Green New Deal is a hazard to health. I think the imperative is let everybody drive their own car, because we don't want to be exposed. The ultimate social distancing is a traffic jam filled with one person in every car, or a family in every car. But speaking of driving, a lot of us listen to music in the car. That is, when we're not listening to the EIB. Rush absolutely loved music. He was a DJ at his heart. He was a DJ before he was a talk show host. Longtime listeners got to know his bumper music and the priceless commentary that went with it, which is why we're doing something called Road Trip with Rush, where every Friday we'll add a new song to a playlist of Rush's favorites and we'll create them together. Think of it as a Maha mixtape. We kicked this off last week with Barry White and the Love Unlimited Orchestra. This week, we bring you back to Rush's childhood and to the song that sparked his passion.
The Happy Organ, Dave Baby Cortez.
'58, I believe. Might have been 1960, whatever. I am 7, 8, 9 years old. And I am listening to KXOK St. Louis. The Radio Park in St. Louis, 6:30 on the dial. Wanting to be on the radio playing the song. When I was 7 years old, 8, 9 years old. That is why this song is in the bumper rotation. Did I ever do DJ views at the parties? No, never did that. Never wanted to do that. I wanted to DJ on the radio, not at the parties. No. That wasn't even invented yet anyway. I mean, DJing at parties? Who wanted to work at parties? I did do the announcements at school once. Yeah, I did the homeroom announcements. I did once. No, didn't do skating rinks. No, no, no. But I remember that's I wanted to be on the radio playing that song. It's 7 years old, folks. I mean, I knew then that's what I wanted to do.
The Happy Organ, Dave Baby Cortez, one of Rush's all-time favorites. I'm Brett Witterbull. I'm your guide host today on the EIB Network. And I'm Brett Witterbull. I am your guide host today on the Rush Limbaugh Show and the EIB Network. Don't forget, every monthly issue of America's number one political newsletter is driven by Rush Limbaugh's vision, humor, and optimism, plus cutting-edge analysis and news. Or cutting-edge news and analysis, as the case may be. As long as liberals do and say stupid stuff, the Limbaugh Letter will prove them wrong and call them out in wildly popular special kind of stupid and stupid quotes features. Subscribe today, and your new subscription includes one free issue, a total of 13 issues. It's available in print and digital editions. Order online today at rushlimbaugh.com. Let's check in with the listeners here on the EIB Network, and we start with Ralph in Coral Springs, Florida. Thank you for patiently holding.
Hey, Brett, thanks a lot for taking the call. Listen, 3 years a vet under President Jimmy Carter, 3 years a vet under Ronald Reagan, 37 years working at FedEx,
wow.
And I'm ready to retire, and we can't retire because Biden is making our money worth cheaper with all this printing and high spending, okay?
Yep.
Now, plenty of people like me want to live those golden years,
mm-hmm.
And now there's too many that are scared to retire because they think the money's not going to be there for them. So that was the biggest point,
yep,
why I called you this morning and hanged on for an eternity.
I know.
Somebody had diarrhea of the mouth.
I know. Look, I'll take the responsibility for that one, Ralph, and I appreciate you saying that, you calling in on this, and thank you for your service. But let me ask you a question. Is there any way possible you can hold on, not on the phones, but hold on for another couple of years until maybe we get a little more sanity coming into the office at the White House?
Remember, when you go to retire, you got to think about your health.
That's right.
Are you going to have those years at the end? I'm not taking that chance. I'm going to turn in my sneakers and go fishing.
I don't blame you. Thank you so much for checking in and your patience. I appreciate you being out there, Ralph. Thank you so much. That's Ralph checking in. Let's go out to Orange County, California. This is Leslie in Irvine. Leslie, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I was calling because I went to go get my second COVID shot today,
mm-hmm.
And it made me think about Biden during his PSA announcement the other night in front of Congress about mm-hmm. everybody needs to go get their vaccination in his whispery voice.
Yeah.
He left out one part of that PSA, which was very important. Don't forget your photo ID. Everybody has to have a photo ID. And you know what? Also, just another comment. While I was in the observation area.
Sure.
I observed, and I think that the left would find this remarkable, or they would experience shock and awe because that room was full of the most diverse group of people. And that's just a normal experience I have every day.
Sure.
We are so diverse.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. And they all had ID. They were diverse and had ID, right?
Of course they did. All races, all genders, I mean, just the whole spectrum of people. So, and then the last thing is, I wish somebody would post a picture, a side-by-side photo of Biden's audience in Congress next to the audience at the Oscars. What a contrast. Nobody in masks. Everybody sitting in booths.
Yep.
And It was just ridiculous.
That's right. But and the Oscars, Leslie, thank you for calling in. And the Oscars, don't forget, they did that at Union Station in L.A. They had to dislocate the homeless who were otherwise camping out there so that the elites and the effete could get together to eat and celebrate each other's awesome accomplishments there at the Oscars. Steve in Allentown, Pennsylvania, welcome to the Rush Limbaugh Show. Hello. Hello, Steven. Steven, yeah. Are you there?
I am.
Hi, what's on your mind today, sir?
Well, A, thank you for being today's guide host.
Thank you, sir.
And continuing the tradition.
Thank you.
I got to say, I enjoyed Trump's nicknames for the swamp dwellers.
Yeah.
And I'd like your opinion on this one. Joe Biden seems intent on transforming the United States of America into Venezuela.
Right.
So I was wondering, can we start calling Joe El Presidente?
Look, you're free to do it. Let's see if it picks up speed. You've just spoken to the largest audience in talk radio. We'll see if it picks up with anybody out there. I think it's worth considering, especially the irony of that nickname. But I'll keep referring to him as President Joe Biden when I'm officially on the air. But maybe off the air, I will refer to him as El Presidente. Maybe it might fit very well. Hey, we're looking forward to listening to a new podcast series debuting in just 2 weeks' time, hosted by our own James Golden, often referred to Rush as Snerdly. Here's the voice you'll hear each week with a new episode.
Rush Limbaugh, the man behind the Golden EIB microphone. It's a new podcast hosted by yours truly, James Golden, or, as many of you know me, Bo Snerdly. I'm going to take you behind the scenes for an intimate look at the man, Rush Limbaugh, who changed America as we know it. It's coming May 12th to iHeartRadio or wherever you listen to your favorite podcast, presented by the Tunnel to Towers Foundation and MyPillow.
Plenty more straight ahead on the Rush Limbaugh Show on the EIB Network. I'm Brett Winterbull. And I am Brett Winterbull. I am your guide host today on the EIB Network. One thing that's important to understand, and I think we take it for granted, what a completely different world in which we now live in this country. There was a time within the last 25 or 30 years that we can look back to a president sitting there in the Oval Office, making an address, making a statement, making a speech somewhere, and laying down a vision for the rest of the world. And that address would be covered, obviously, by our cable systems or our over-the-air broadcast systems here in the United States. But now with the advent of technology, big technology, all that sort of stuff, everything the president says goes all the way around the world to the furthest remote reaches of this planet. And so the messaging coming from President Biden is one of distress and one of weakness and one of suffering. And it's important for us to remember how that plays in foreign capitals, in Tehran, in Beijing, in the places that wish us ill. And it's even more important because, as Ronald Reagan talked about tearing down this wall and calling the Soviets an evil empire, we have essentially messaging coming from Joe Biden that says something on the order of, well, we might not be able to do it. Think about that on the EIB Network. Hour number three underway here on the Rush Limbaugh Show on the EIB Network. One of the great things that's happening is we're starting to see a return to some measure of normalcy as more and more people are getting vaccinated. The coronavirus, the COVID-19 is moving downward in terms of cases. Lockdowns are starting to wind down to a greater extent. I know we still have some flare-ups. We have stuff in Oregon. Michigan's been suffering lately, no doubt. But by and large, it appears that there is a substantial effort being made to try to reopen our economy, to reopen our country, and to reopen some of the grand traditions. I mean, just last night we had the NFL draft first round. You actually had people in attendance. You had people in attendance. You had players in attendance. You had throngs of fanatics for their teams there present in Cleveland. Well, coming up tomorrow, it's the Kentucky Derby, which reminds us of an epic monologue that Rush did decade ago about the movie Secretariat.
We watched a movie over the weekend, Secretariat. I was surprised. It's a good movie. And I saw a review of this movie if there's anything that indicates the cultural divide that we're in, I mean, Secretariat, it's a Disney movie, and it's all about never quitting, never giving up. I was 22 years old when Secretariat won the Triple Crown. That was 1973. And I had just left home, and I was starting in my radio career, and I didn't pay a whole lot of attention to the details. I just knew the horse won the Triple Crown. I had forgotten how phenomenal the horse was, and I did not know any of the backstory of the horse's ownership or syndicate, which is what the movie is really all about. A woman who didn't know a thing about the horse business inherits it. Everybody in her family and outside says, you got to sell it. She's offered $8 million for the horse, where she owes $6 million to stay afloat. She turns it down because she's believing that the horse can win the Triple Crown. It'll be worth three times that. She turns out to be right, but everybody tells her she can't do it. I mean, the values here are superb. And there's this review in Salon.com of this movie that slams Secretariat as a Tea Party fantasy. I mean, here is a movie about... I mean, standard good old-fashioned, you can do it if you put your mind to it, values, and it gets slammed by a guy. When you first read this review, you think it's a satire, and as you keep going, you find out that this guy is dead serious. In its totality, Secretariat is a work of creepy, half-hilarious master race propaganda, almost worthy of Leni Riefenstahl. She was Hitler's videographer. And all the more effective because it presents as a family-friendly yarn about a nice lady and her horse. Nothing in the movie is not true, and this is said to be a half-hilarious master race propaganda. Almost worthy of Leni Riefenstahl. Secretariat actually goes much further, presenting a honey-dipped fantasy version of the American past as the Tea Party would like to imagine it, loaded with uplift and glory and scrubbed clean of multiculturalism and social discord. Nothing could be further from the truth. It's 1973. Her own kids are hippies. They're going to Woodstock. They're blowing weed. They're having doobies. The woman's out there trying to save her father's horse farm. Happens to be she wins a coin toss and gets the fold that produces Secretariat. And the rest is history. It really is fascinating. I tell people that here we are in 2010. The media always hated Ronald Reagan. The media hated Richard Nixon. We've always had a partisan political divide. But the abject hatred that is aimed at decent, middle-of-the-road Americans by the mainstream cultural left is something like I've never seen before. There is nothing in this movie to hate. There's nothing in this movie to dislike. It's a harmless movie. In fact, it's uplifting. Even I, ladies and gentlemen, El Rushbo and Catherine, we're watching it together. I got a little misty-eyed at the end of this movie. I wouldn't normally admit that to you people. I'm supposed to be Mr. Tough and Gruff and so forth. I got misty-eyed. When I start crying, I actually suppress it, try not to. And so I clear my throat, and I was stunned. I saw Seabiscuit, I've seen horse movies, but I didn't know the backstory to this. I wasn't even going to spend that much time talking about it. You know me, I don't talk about movies until I read this review at Salon.com. Again, in its totality, Secretariat's a work of creepy, half-hilarious master race propaganda, almost worthy of Hitler's videographer. And all the more effective because it presents as a family-friendly yarn about a nice lady and her horse. Secretariat actually goes much further, presenting a honey-dipped fantasy vision of the American past, as the Tea Party would like to imagine it, loaded with uplift and glory and scrubbed clean of multiculturalism and social discord. I mean, there was all kinds of multiculturalism. The groom is black. The trainer is French-Canadian, portrayed by a Jewish guy. Diane Lane, no conservative, plays the lead role here. Penny Tweedy. I mean, her kids, a couple of them, you know, maggot-infested, long-haired rock and roller types, blowing doobies. And this guy says that there's no multiculturalism in it. In fact, this woman's husband, I mean, you could reverse the roles. This woman's husband gets mad because she's never home. She's off running the family business. 1973, the feminazis should love this. The feminazis should latch onto this and say, this is what we were talking about, except she doesn't have an abortion. Maybe the feminazis couldn't latch into her for that. But regardless, to say that this thing is milquetoast and pure fantasy and all this hunky-dory little so sweet that you can get an insulin shock from it is ridiculous. what's this guy's name? Andrew O apostrophe H E H I R. Probably O'Hare. Probably pronounced O'Hare. And this actually the guy obviously feels threatened by the movie. I had no idea. It opened this weekend. I had no idea how it did. The year Secretariat won the Triple Crown, this is from the Review, was the year the Vietnam War ended and the Watergate hearings began. You could hardly pick a period in post-Civil War American history more plagued by chaos and division and general insanity. Okay, well, you could pick right now, maybe. Wallace references that social context in the most glancing and dismissive manner possible. Penny's eldest daughter depicted as a teen anti-war activist. But our heroine's double life as a Denver housewife and Virginia horse farm owner proceeds pretty much as if the 50s had gone on forever. The words Vietnam and Nixon are never uttered. Well, I don't know what Nixon or Vietnam had to do with Secretariat. I don't know that Secretariat ever knew him. Secretariat was a horse. Sports, you have to call horse racing a sport, sports has always been an escape from the daily humdrum. Sports has always been fantasy island for people. It's what most of us wish we could do. Wish we had the talent to do. Wish we had the ability. That's the beauty of spectator sports. It's the one thing I always say in which you can totally invest passion without consequence. You can't do that in any other area of life. You're always guarded with your team. You'll give them everything you got. The only thing they'll do, though, may disappoint you and lose. Of course, my team did kick me out of the stadium once, but normally that doesn't happen. It happens to me, but I was able to take it, rebounded well from it, as is evidenced by the fact that I'm still here. It's a fun movie, and this horse won the Belmont Stakes by 31 lengths. I had forgotten that. I don't know that I ever knew it at the time. And the theory was this horse couldn't last that long in the Belmont. The horse's history was to start last in the pack and then accelerate for the whole race and win. And the same thing happened at Belmont. Only five horses in the final. It never trailed. And 31 lengths has never been done since. Not even close. There's nothing in this movie to feel threatened by. There's nothing in this movie to dislike. The only thing in this movie is to be informed, educated, enlightened, inspired. What part made me cry? Just the ending. When everything came together.
This is a great example of how far we've come, or better yet, how far we've slid. So you see this piece by Andrew O'Hare talking about how out of touch and wrong the Secretariat movie was. Well, this is 2010. Rush has the power of the EIB microphone. He's talking about what a great movie it was because he personally saw it. He's offering you a counter-narrative to what it is you're getting from Andrew O'Hare trying to say this is some kind of a terrible movie. It's a terrible story. But think about how far we have slid in 11 years, because if this were replicated today exactly as it played out, Salon, Review, here's a movie, Secretariat, no diversity, Tea Party Dream, comparisons to Hitler, comparisons to Leni Riefenstahl, comparisons to all of that, this movie would have been canceled. Like, if you just listen to the descriptive by this guy O'Hare, this movie would have been canceled if this movie, if Secretariat, had come out in 2020, 2021. They'd been like, we got to get rid of it. We can't put it out. This thing is radioactive. I mean, my gosh, it's the review itself says it's Nazi-esque. I mean, we can't do this at all. This is terrible. It's triumphal. Doesn't mention Vietnam or Richard Nixon. It's remarkable when you think, right? Because Rush being the counterweight, and I know I'm getting political on something that was a really great feel-good story, which it is. Secretariat's a great story. But this illustrates how far we've gone in 11 years. Because this guy was taking pot shots. I don't think he was necessarily trying to cancel it, but he wanted to be the smartest guy in the room, unaffected by the movie. Today, somebody writes that review of this movie being released now, or of a movie similar to that being released now. They're sunk. Major corporations are pulling out. They won't allow you to sell concessions of their products in the theater if you dare show the movie. That's why, this is exactly why Rush is so timeless. Because it shows you along that timeline how much more extreme the left has gotten. Secretariat's a great movie. I'm Brett Winterbull. I'm your guide host today. on the EIB Net. And I am Brett Witterbull, your guide host here on the Rush Limbaugh Show on the EIB Network. Let's go back to the phones and check in with some of the great people across country. Sharon is in Houston, Texas, joining us on the program. Sharon, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi, Brett. Thank you. Thank you for that great review you gave us of what it was like under the Obama administration when he was constantly degrading our country and degrading us as Americans. And it's good for us to remember those things. And as you were, I was texting my son as you were talking to tell him about the points you were making because it was so good.
Thank you.
He doesn't have time to listen to radio. But I wanted to say I remembered something. I'd like to add something to what Obama said.
Go ahead.
And he said that our economy was in decline and it was not coming back. And
that's right.
And then he told everyone the 2016 election that Hillary would be his third term and that he was on the slate, or however he said it, but he considered Hillary to be his third term.
Right.
And he was determined our economy was not going to come back. We did not deserve it. We didn't earn it. We didn't deserve it. It was not coming back.
That's right.
And so we need to remember that. And now Biden is up there as Obama's third term to show us, yes, indeed, our economy will not come back. And so we need to remember this. And then when you added that thing at the end about how he, or just after all of that, you said that he has Biden in shutting down the pipeline.
Mm-hmm.
He has rerouted the oil from Canada over to China. That's a huge big deal.
Well, it's not that Biden has done that, but the closure is effectively going to send the Canadians have said they're going to have to sell their oil someplace, and they're going to send it out across the Pacific.
That's right, and that is a huge big deal. And the Biden administration wants everybody to think that oil is dirty, mm-hmm. and while they hand out subsidies to all the green things. And they're doing everything backwards, and it's all part of the plan to make our economy decline,
right.
and put us in a state of decline. But don't worry, the government's going to take care of us while it drains our treasury dry.
Did you happen to see yesterday, or even coverage on the news of it, Sharon, of the rally he attended yesterday in Georgia? Did you see any of the pictures of that?
No, I did not. I don't
watch
TV.
No, it's okay. It's okay. You'll appreciate this. Remember what Joe Biden's stock and trade was during the campaign? It was to have these rallies, but how did the people attend the rallies? Do you remember how they attended the rallies? They attend in cars. They sat in cars. I don't know how he thinks that these folks are going to get. I know what's going to happen. Yes, they'll switch to electric cars. It'll be great. They'll switch to pedal-powered cars and sail-powered cars. But by and large, most people drive regular cars that use gasoline or diesel. And so for Biden to be hammering away like he is, it's incredible. Now, here's the other thing, and I appreciate that call, Sharon. You're a great caller. I appreciate you conveying the points to your son as well. But here's the other thing that's important for this agenda, and that is an enforcement mechanism. So as you saw back, we played the clips earlier in the week of Rush talking about Lois Lerner and the Tea Party case that came in front of the IRS, right? Remember when the IRS was surveilling the Tea Party groups? The only way you're able to quell the dissent that they want you to quell, if you are trying to run the government as either Biden or Obama, you have to quell dissent, but you have to do it in a very specific way, and that is using the federal government, the IRS, in the case of what happened with Lois Lerner and the Tea Party, in the case of Eric Holder, and of course Fast and Furious, they used the Department of Justice and the BATFE to allow those guns to flow into the hands of the Sinaloa cartel. And now what are we seeing? We're seeing the Department of Justice getting activated to go after people like Rudy Giuliani and others who are opponents of the regime. And I think it's important to note that that's what's going on. Let's go to Arizona, a beautiful place. Phoenix, Arizona. And Chris, welcome to the Rush Limbaugh Show, Chris.
Hi, thanks. Hey, I was just going to say, with all the stuff about Kerry and everything, I agree with what you're saying. And
sure.
The prosecution, at least take a look at what this guy's doing. But here's the problem. Every conservative that I know sits around and goes, so what? And they've actually changed Hillary's name over to a method. And let me give you an example. He's just going to pull a Hillary. Let's just destroy the devices, destroy the evidence and everything. But at the end of the day, let's say they even do prosecute the guy. It doesn't matter anyway, because Biden and the entire administration, they'll just pardon him anyway. So pretty much, you know, all these people that I know are just going, so what? We just, and everybody sadly is throwing up their hands in this. I don't mean to be a negative Nancy on the whole thing, but
sure.
Seriously, they're not going to do anything. They're above the law. There's a separate set of laws for them and us. And so even if he was prosecuted, he and everybody out there knows nothing's going to happen. It never does.
Oh, okay. So can I fire back the point sort of back at you in a respectful way?
I'd love to hear some, to hear some good news out of
so, it. So here's the thing. So by that account, the Republicans could just say, what's the big deal to try to stop the $6 trillion in spending that Biden wants? Because after all, they're just going to figure out a way to beat us, and they're going to figure out a way to get the trillions of dollars out. It's worth taking. It costs nothing to point out what John Kerry has done and to show that he's a dishonest broker. If he doesn't get convicted, if he doesn't get, you know, a pardon, whatever it is, the world should still know what's going on, and we should still talk about this. Lord knows they would about our guys. And I think it's worth the fight. And we shouldn't give them an inch. Rush said that in a segment earlier today that we played. Don't even give them an inch. You have to fight them at every corner. And that's what it comes down to, Chris.
I could not agree with you more. I think you're spot on. I'm just
and I hear your frustration. And I feel your frustration.
Yeah, for the rest of people listening, it's like, why, you know, we're kind of giving up. And if you can encourage people, keep going, keep nailing things out. You know, that's the way to go. Thanks.
All the best to you. I appreciate you calling. You're a great caller. Brian is in Summerfield, North Carolina, and is next up. Brian, welcome to the Rush Limbaugh Show.
Hey, thank you. Hey, I wanted to call basically in response to your question the other day about Tim Scott's response.
Sure.
And basically, it's kind of funny because you just played that thing about Rush Limbaugh's review of that horse movie.
Mm-hmm.
He made the exact point that I was trying to make, and that is, or you did kind of, and that is that we as Republicans, as conservatives, we need to understand that we are actually at war with the Democrats. We do not act like that. That is our big problem. They are playing for keeps. We're trying to play nice. If you listen to Tim Scott, the whole time he's trying to be, oh, look at me. I'm a really nice guy, and I'm very politically, you know, savvy. And, oh, let's be nice, and let's try to work with these guys and reach across the aisle, and let's do the right things, and blah, blah, blah. It was like, no. Tim, fight. Call them out for their stupidity. Call them out for what is wrong with their stuff. And don't be nice about it, because they're not nice about it when they do it to us. We need a fighter. That's why I wanted, I think the question was asked, who would you have rather seen?
Sure, who would you brought in?
Give that response. I want Ted Cruz. I want Jim Jordan. I want somebody who's going to poke them in the eye and poke them in the chest and say, this is why you're wrong. This is why this is stupid. This is why this will hurt the country. This is why we need to do it our way, not your way. And no, we're not going to sit there and worry about reaching across the aisle. Oh, let's work with them. Let's meet halfway. Why would you meet halfway on stuff that you know is stupid?
But wait a minute. I would not mistake Tim Scott's tone for going soft. I think he was quiet spoken because it's his nature. He's not a yeller or a desk pounder. But I think it's a mistake to think that he wasn't strong. He called out Biden on it not being Jim Crow there in Georgia. He said America's not a racist nation. He rebutted the points. He did it in a calm and confident way. I think stylistically we can disagree on how the message was delivered, but I do think Tim Scott was effective in a number of ways, because had Jordan gone out and done it, or Cruz or somebody else gone out and done it, the media would have made them the story. Instead, we're talking about Joe Biden wanting to spend $6 trillion, and we've got momentum on our side. Brett Winterbull on the EIB Network. Wonderful to be here. The Biden administration wants to propose a ban on menthol cigarettes. The FDA is considering a ban on menthol cigarettes in an effort to curb disproportionate health burdens on African Americans. Over 7 out of 10 black youths aged 12 to 17 who reported smoking use menthol cigarettes. And black adults have the highest percentage of menthol cigarette use compared with other racial groups. Now, the ACLU, along with dozens of others, including the Drug Policy Alliance, say that while such a ban is well-intentioned, it would have serious racial justice implications. They say that such a ban will trigger criminal penalties, which will be disproportionately impacting people of color, as well as prioritizing criminalization over public health and harm reduction. Back in 2008, Rush talked about the FDA's decision then not to ban menthol-flavored cigarettes. Here's what that sounded like.
By the way, ladies and gentlemen, from the New York Times today, this is just too rich. This is just too good. Some public health experts are questioning why menthol, the most widely used cigarette flavoring and the most popular cigarette choice of African-American smokers, is receiving special protection as Congress tries to regulate tobacco for the first time. The legislation, which would give the FDA the power to oversee tobacco products, would try to reduce smoking's allure to young people by banning most flavored cigarettes, including clove and cinnamon. But those new strictures would exempt menthol, even though menthol masks the harsh taste of cigarettes for beginners, may make it harder for the addicted to kick the smoking habit. For years, public health authorities have worried that menthol might be a factor in high cancer rates in African Americans. Now, the reason that menthol is seen as politically off limits is that mentholated brands are so crucial to the American cigarette industry. They make up more than one-fourth of the $70 billion American cigarette market. They are becoming increasingly important to the industry leader, Philip Morris, without whose lobbying support the legislation might have no chance of passage. Do you see where this is going, folks? Have you connected the dots on this already? Menthol particularly controversial because public health authorities are worried about its health effects on African Americans. Nearly 75% of black smokers use menthol brands, compared with only about 1 in 4 white smokers. Now, some of you might be saying, why? Why are they exempting menthol from the ban on flavored cigarettes? You think about it, folks. You think about it, and I'll clue you in when we get back. Okay, have you had enough time here to think about, ladies and gentlemen, why indeed the U.S. Congress is going to exempt menthol flavoring from the ban on flavored cigarettes? Especially when you find out that 75% of menthol cigarettes are purchased by African Americans. Can you imagine what's going to happen when the Reverend Jeremiah Wright finds out about this? When the Reverend Jeremiah Wright finds out that 75% of blacks smoke menthol-flavored cigarettes and that menthol's the only flavoring that's not going to be banned, what do you think he's going to charge? He's going to say that this is a planned genocide against African Americans who smoke by the U.S. government in this country. And would he be wrong? Now, some of you might be saying, no, Rush, that's you're wrong, and Jeremiah Wright would be wrong. They're just afraid of reaction from the black population. They need the black votes, and they're not going to disturb anything, upset the black. Oh, okay, let's go with that theory. I don't care which theory you use. I don't care which answer you use. It still proves that those in government say they're out to save lives are lying to us.
And that's a huge point there towards the end, especially because we have been told for all these years that cigarettes will kill you, right? Oh, they'll kill you. You're going to die. You smoke, you'll die. It's terrible. It's the worst thing that you can possibly do. And who is it that profits off of cigarettes arguably more than anybody else? Government. Oh, my gosh. Rob Reiner spearheaded. He led this fight to fund pre-K, universal pre-K in the state of California by additional taxes on cigarettes. So pretend everybody woke up tomorrow and decided they don't want to smoke cigarettes anymore. You will be denying children. You'll be denying children the education they require at universal pre-K. Well, no, actually you won't, because you're getting the $1 trillion from Biden to educate them. But pretend that the Biden money didn't exist. Pretend there wasn't that money there. Government says, you know what? Okay, a pack of cigarettes, yeah, it should cost $2.20, but in New York, I don't know, Mr. Broadcast Engineer, I'm not in New York. What does a pack of cigarettes cost in New York? $20 a pack? So $20 a pack. But what does the cigarettes really cost? It's like $3, $2, and then you've got like $17 in taxes. Well, what if everybody woke up and decided they weren't going to smoke anymore? You know, menthol cigarettes, you know, other cigarettes. What would happen then? We can't fund our welfare programs. We can't fund our universal pre-K programs. We can't fund our special phony baloney slush fund programs. I mean, this is what's really crazy, because the government will tell you on one hand, we want to take care of you. We give you Obamacare. You have Obamacare. You have free breakfast at the school. You have USDA food stamps. You have free college. You have affordable home loans. You've got, I mean, just think about everything the government can give you in terms of, you know, aiding you in your daily travels. And then they say, but cigarettes, people shouldn't smoke. But I'll tell you what, honestly, what are we going to do here on the cigarettes? Because we need to fund the universal pre-K, or otherwise Rob Reiner is going to get upset in California, and we can't do it. I always go back to the genesis of things like this, and I say, who's the first guy that invents menthol cigarettes? I mean, who's the first guy that says, you know, this tobacco is pretty nasty, but this might make it taste better? I always wonder about that. Like, is there a guy sitting at home doing Ancestry.com or something, right? I'm not endorsing anybody. I'm not talking about anybody like that. But I'm saying he's doing his Ancestry. He's doing his family tree, right? And he says, honey, you know our great-great uncle Steve back from 1826? You know that guy? That guy? Uncle, great, 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 great Uncle Steve, he invented the menthol cigarette. Did somebody ever, I mean, really, when you think about it, like, did any kid sit in a classroom and say, I want to write an article on the great inventors? Alexander Graham Bell, Thomas Edison. Here's the guy. This guy was unbelievable. He invented the menthol cigarette. Traditional cigarettes were not enough for him. He wanted to have minty, smoky breath. So he invented the menthol cigarette. And then he found out that you could also use the menthol on your chest if you had a cold. Or you couldn't breathe because you'd been smoking menthol. I just wonder about this kind of stuff. It's like, does anybody claim people like that? Darn it. We could have been wealthy. But when our family went their separate ways, we missed out on the menthol cigarette fortune. Just these things that just kind of make you wonder about that, right? I mean, where exactly does it come from? But again, the hypocrisy of government is rich. The hypocrisy of government is profound when you think about, we don't want anybody to die. We want you to get all of your vegetables. We want you to get all of your exercise. We want to put the calorie counts on the restaurant boards and all that kind of stuff. We want to do all of that kind of stuff. But we need you guys to go out and you don't have to smoke. Maybe that's the out. You don't have to smoke them. You just have to buy them. In fact, we prefer you to buy them and not smoke them. But just pay that tax to keep. That's got to be what the loophole is. Just worked right through it. Makes complete and total sense. And I just think it's an incredible thing that we're looking at in this country. You know, we're big fans of Legacy Box, the company that's been digitally transferring videotapes and old family movies onto computer files and DVDs. More than a million families have used Legacy Box's services. Rush introduced this discovery of his to this audience years ago and was one of their biggest champions. Just listen to the way he described the process.
Family members always interested in sharing pictures and videos with each other. Smartphones make that real easy these days, almost second nature. But how about all of those videos and family movies from long ago when everybody used camcorders, Betamax, Super 8, whatever it is, Betamax, VHS, all that stuff. And then Super 8 millimeter film and all those movies you have, they're safely stored away out of reach, but they're not capable of being seen because nobody's got the players anymore. Nobody's got the media. Unless you use Legacy Box, then if you use Legacy Box, all that stuff can be brought back to life. Legacy Box makes it easy. What they do, they ship you one of their specially made boxes so that you can ship these family memories back to them and make sure they don't get damaged in transit. Ship it back to Legacy Box, Tennessee. In a couple of weeks, you will get digital copies or digital files of all those family videos or films or pictures, whatever you've sent them. You'll be able to share all of that for the first time in who knows how long. You'll be able to share it with DVD or thumb drive or computer link with every family member you want. You talk about a family present. Talk about making family happy. This is it. You got some things, no doubt, in your attic that people in your family have not seen in decades. Now you can bring it all back to life. LegacyBox.com/rush is the website to make it happen. That's the website you want for this. LegacyBox.com/rush. You will save 50% off the regular price of their services today if you use that address. LegacyBox.com/rush.
I'm Brett Winterbull. your guide host today on the EIB Network. It is my favorite time of the program. The EIB High Note. It really is. I love the EIB High Note. It's a throwback to Team EIB today, which Rush often referred to as the highly overrated staff, endearingly, of course, and of which I am a proud member. Now, we put together a montage of mentions, and you'll even hear me in there.
Once again, my highly overrated staff has let me down, not telling me that today is a worldwide holiday.
Oh, welcome to the studio, Mr. Creeley. I didn't see you slither in there. The EIB Network now has an official Obama criticizer. He is Bo Snerdly. I got Cookie working on the soundbite even now. You might be confusing Cookie with Coco. Coco is married to Cookie. Coco runs the website. Coco is the gorilla that the TV show is now runs the website. He's the webmaster. If you haven't done so yet, you've got to go to rushlimbaugh.com. You've not seen anything like this. It is indescribable. I would not do it justice trying to describe this. But the web team has been working on this for months, and it is stunning. The video is actually taken from the control room. What you see, the back of the broadcast engineer's head, Brian Johnson, which is as close to fame as Brian says he wants to get. That was Greg Chapin's idea back in the cave there where these guys put these bites together after Cookie cracks the whip and tells them what to do. So what we've done, Joe Muñiz on our staff has recorded all of what I said in Espanol. Mamon, the broadcast engineer, had a different idea. I just sent a picture up to Coco Jr., whose actual name is Dean. My security guy, Joseph Stalin, Craig Kitchen from our staff, Kit Carson, former irreplaceable chief of staff and trusted right hand, Diana Schneider, editrix of the Limbaugh Letter. Again, I don't want to spend any time today, Mr. Winterbull, on legal marijuana, illegal marijuana. It's happened before in this program. Dawn, are you irritated by this? You don't like this? I thought I detected a facial expression. Dawn transcribes calls to this program. She's sitting in there, and her face getting contorted and so forth, and I knew it. I wanted to issue a special thanks to the, I call them highly overrated staff. They may be, but they're incredibly valuable. They're incredibly loyal. They are incredibly committed. And they are exceptionally, exceptionally devoted. And none of this could happen without them.
And none of it would happen without Rush. And it was an incredible time with him, and he was just absolutely the best. When he mentioned you, you instantly got a smile on your face. You know, if you're a podcast listener, you're going to want to subscribe and listen to a new podcast created in honor of Rush. It's hosted by none other than our James Golden. Here's the voice that will help remind you of the greatness of our beloved Rush. James Golden
Rush
himself.
Rush Limbaugh, the man behind the Golden EIB microphone. It's a new podcast hosted by yours truly, James Golden, or, as many of you know me, Bo Snerdly. I'm going to take you behind the scenes for an intimate look at the man, Rush Limbaugh, who changed America as we know it. It's coming May 12th to iHeartRadio or wherever you listen to your favorite podcast, presented by MyPillow and the Tunnel to Towers Foundation.
It is going to be destination listening. Be sure you subscribe. It's going to be phenomenal. I'm Brett Winterbull, your guide host here on the EIB Network. And a final thought as we make our way towards the door here, and I would be remiss if I didn't share this with you. It's important to remember that we need to be optimistic, we need to be confident, and we need to know and understand that this fight in front of us, that we have in front of us for our freedom, our liberty, our opportunity, it's not going to be easy. It never is. It never is. You can't expect that it's going to just be a cakewalk. This is going to take convincing people. This is going to take making the argument stick, and then convincing people again. So we do not want socialism. We do not want to be a fully dependent society. We don't want a great reset. We want the opportunity to chart our own course, and we want the opportunity to see our children succeed, regardless of your background. Where you end up is totally in your hands. And it's important to be optimistic about this. I know Rush was one of the most optimistic people I've ever been around, and I know he would be optimistic for this country, but also would understand that this is going to take a real fight in the political sense. It's been a real pleasure being with each and every one of you this entire week. I've had an absolute blast, and I'd be remiss if I didn't thank the great people who make this happen, including Ali and Greg and Amon and Craig and Joe and Coco Jr., Dean. Everybody there together gets together each and every day to keep this legacy alive, to keep this show alive, and to keep it moving forward. Ken Matthews and Jason Lewis will be guiding you next week. I'm Brett Witterbull on the EIB Network.